Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is July 28th, 2025, and my guest is Professor of English and author David Wyatt of the University of Maryland. He teaches and writes about 20th century American literature, including Ernest Hemingway. Our topic for today is Hemingway's novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls. David, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thanks for having me, Russ. Happy to be here.
I want to let listeners know that there will be some spoilers, so if you want to enjoy the book without those, please read it before you listen to this episode. Now, the novel's set in the Spanish Civil War, which isn't even 100 years old, but is probably forgotten by many. Give us a thumbnail sketch of the war. What was it about, and what was Hemingway's involvement?
You can see the Spanish Civil War as a run-up to World War II, a proxy war in which various countries took sides in the initial fight between fascism and democracy. It took place in Spain from 1936 to 1939, and it was a war that was perhaps timed at that point in history because Spain had never had its French Revolution. In France, it was a class war as well. The military, the aristocracy, the church, the bankers on one side, and a whole array of a different class of persons on the other. France kept fighting this war, you might say, for the next 150 years. Spain never had such an outbreak. And so in some sense, the pressures that were released in France and in Germany and Italy in the 19th century came to a head in Spain in the 30s because of the growing gap, you might say, between the haves and the have-nots. In the mid-30s, the Popular Front was elected to run the country. It was called the Republic. And this movement was an attempt to redistribute land, money, power, and it was resisted by the powers that be. When the front came in, they began an attack on the clergy and the churches, and there was some killing of priests. At this point, the forces on the right decided to take arms, and under Francisco Franco, they began a rebellion against the elected government called the Republic. So on the one hand, you had Franco and his fascist. On the other hand, you had this newly elected Republic. So it was a war between, you might say, the old guard and the new. And into this war came support from Germany and Italy for Franco and the fascist, and the Soviet Union supports the Republic. So it's a proxy war in that sense. And what happens is that the support from the fascists is much more effective than it is from the Soviet Union. There's also an American contingent, about 300 or 3,000 American soldiers, volunteers, form the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And Robert Jordan, the protagonist of Whom the Bell Tolls, is a kind of member of that brigade. These Americans fought for the Republic. When I say that this fascist support was more effective, you see this in the novel when the planes come and bomb El Sordo. These are planes, German and Italian planes, probably mostly German planes. So that Franco and his fascists were much more well-equipped than the other side. Hemingway loved Spain, and he had been going there since the early 1920s, probably his favorite country in Europe. When the war breaks out, he decides he wants to cover it. He's a war correspondent. He was a correspondent in the Greco-Turkish War, the Spanish Civil War, World War II. He went to the wars. So he spends four visits in Spain, gets there in 37, about, half a year or so, 9 months after the war begins. He sets up headquarters in Madrid, and there he falls in love with Martha Gellhorn, another war correspondent. And this is when their affair begins and will eventually lead to his divorce from Pauline Pfeiffer and his marriage with Martha. So he goes to the war. He goes to the front. He's often in action. He's not carrying a gun, but he's very close to the front lines in many cases. He befriends the great photographer Robert Capa, the war photographer. And he says at one point, "We were never happier than when we thought the Republic had a chance to win." Of course, the Republic lost. Franco wins. And for the next 30 years, Spain exists under a kind of right-wing oppression, which eventually is lifted in the 1970s.
So the other thing I just want to add about the Spanish Civil War, first, many intellectuals got involved, typically on the side of the Republic and the communists. George Orwell famously broke with communism after seeing how what happened in the Spanish Civil War. Lost a lot of friends. We did an episode with Christopher Hitchens on that long, long time ago, which we'll link to. But the other thing I want to add is that, so the war goes 36 to 39. It ends with Franco ascendant as dictator, a position he holds till 1975. Hemingway was clearly on the side of the Republic against the fascists. Robert Jordan, the protagonist, is clearly on the side. He's fighting for the Republic against the fascists. And the book is banned in Spain until 1968, which is really amazing. And then the other thing I just want to add is this was a very brutal conflict. I read, I suppose it's accurate, 200,000 people died. There was bombing of civilians, which was, as you suggested, another prelude to the tragedy of World War II's, you know, bombing of civilians in London and Japan and Germany. And it's a brutal, brutal thing. Guernica, Picasso's painting is an example of that. When does Hemingway, so the war goes 36 to 39. When does Hemingway write this book, and when does it come out, and how is it received?
He begins writing it in late 38, early 39, and he spends about 9 or 10 months writing it. It's published in 1940. It's very well received, and a movie with Gary Cooper and Ingrid Bergman is made fairly quickly thereafter. Many of Hemingway's books were made into films. So it's percolating inside of him during the four visits he makes to Spain. And he finally decides to sit down and write what became his longest novel.
Yeah. It's for those of you who haven't read, this is fiction, obviously, but those of you who have not read Hemingway's Wartime Correspondence, I recommend it. There's a collection of that from his writing on World War II that is really quite extraordinary. And clearly he was up close to many wartime battles and situations. Now, I mentioned that Orwell soured on communism after his experience in Spain. Hemingway, my understanding is he was criticized both by the left and the right for this book. The left felt it wasn't pro-Republic enough. The right obviously didn't like it. I mentioned it was banned in Spain. Did he ever comment or write after the war beyond this publication of this book about and reflect back on the Spanish Civil War?
You know, I'm not sure I can answer that question fully. I don't recall any such comment. I would say this about your point, which is that in this novel, clearly Robert Jordan is taken aside. He's very passionate about his support of the Republic. But in Hemingway's treatment of the enemy, of the other, particularly Lieutenant Berendo, who is ends up riding into the sights of Robert's rifle on the last page of the book, he gives that character, who is an enemy figure, an inner life, a kind of dignity, and a kind of respect, so that in a strange way, this book avoids a kind of ideological side-taking. It shows a lot of the flaws in the strategy being promoted by his own side. At one point, Robert tries to call off the entire blowing of the bridge. So he's quite honest about the deficiencies, you might say, in the side that Robert is supporting. And it's a novel, so it's not an ideological tract. And in that sense, he wants to give even the other side the dignity of at least having an inner life. Not that he ever agreed with the ultimate values or the triumph of the fascists, but as a novelist, it was important to him to not turn the enemy into cardboard figures. Hemingway, in this novel, I think, masters what I'd call the art of empathy, of feeling for and with almost every character that he presents. And it's part of the reason why I love the book so much is that it seems to me a much more full-hearted, generous, and affirmative book than anything he had previously written.
And it's a fantastic observation that they're not cardboard figures. More than that, the characters on Robert Jordan's side, we don't hear much, almost nothing directly from the characters on the other side, the fascists. We do get their inner world a little bit. But from the Robert Jordan side, there's an immense amount of discomfort at killing, even though they're their enemy, because a lot of times they're seeing the faces of the men that they're killing. They understand that they do feel they're doing something they think they should be doing, and they respect that. And in varying amounts, and part of the power of the book is how differently different characters cope with that moral challenge. In varying amounts, they have guilt, shame, a feeling of a lost humanity in their execution of the job of wartime killing. And it's, I think, extraordinary. And you're right. They're all, even the most flawed characters, of which, Pablo is probably the most despicable, gets his day in court in the reader's mind and has a few redeeming moments, even though he's probably the least likable of the group.
Two responses. One about the point about killing. Early on, Anselmo, the old man, he says, "I'm an old man who will live until I die," and eventually is killed near the end. Anselmo raises the issue of killing, and he asks a question early on of Robert, who forgives? Who forgives, Anselmo says, since we no longer have God? A pretty astonishing thing for a Spanish, not peasant exactly, but working man to say. And the novel takes up the whole issue of forgiveness, or what I would call self-forgiveness. That is, how do you live with the things you have done that you, for which you might need to seek forgiveness, killing among them. But there are lots of other sins, if you will, that Robert and others contemplate in their own lives. Pablo, as you mentioned, Pablo is the great figure of change. I think this novel is about whether or not people can change or grow or learn. It's a novel of education, and that's one of the words Robert applies to himself. He says, "I was learning very fast near the end." Pablo gets three chances, not just two. He gets three chances. Times he betrays the band. He finally comes back, and when he finally comes back, he comes back with the detonators and with some more men, so he helps out a bit at the end, and he fights well at the end, although he loses all of his men. So through Pablo, I think Hemingway is exploring the whole issue of change, and in Pablo's case, he doesn't change. He vacillates. Change for Hemingway is when you turn against the self you have been, and you learn, you're educated, to live differently, and this is what Robert undergoes in this book. And he undergoes it because, unlike any other character in the earlier novels, he is given a past. Hemingway gives him memory. He gives him memory.
Yeah. I just want to say one strange thing about the pace. Then I want to ask you something else. But, there's a weird tension in that time moves extremely slowly in this book. We're waiting. Everybody's waiting. We're waiting for this mission to reach its conclusion. And in a way, that's what the whole book is. In a minute, we'll talk about why it's so much more than that. But on the surface, it's just a bunch of people waiting around to do something they think they have to do. They know it's dangerous. They think it's important. It's not easy. And they get it done. So you can feel the clock kind of just ticking, ticking, ticking. And at the same time, time is speeding up tremendously. And as you gave one example, you talk about his feeling that he's learning very quickly. And I think that's we think of life's lessons. I feel I'm a little bit wiser, perhaps, than I was 50 years ago when I first read this book. This is my second read. But as you get older, you start thinking, yeah, I understand some things I didn't understand before. And Robert Jordan's a young man, and he gets those lessons. And at the same time, he has this whirlwind romance with Maria that he expects might only last 3 days. He gets mm-hmm. 3.5-ish days. And we'll come back and talk about that. But this, just on this issue of time, there's this weird rubbing your stomach and patting your head going on where time is incredibly slow. And when is this going to happen? And this mission to get the dispatch to General Galtz is just like interminable. And they're waiting. And at the same time, he's hurtling towards the end of the book. And many, many things are happening at an accelerated pace. I hadn't realize that until we talked. I think that's an extraordinary achievement to have those two things going on at the same time.
Well, that's a brilliant description of the two tensions at work. On the one hand, it's a book about the proper timing of an explosion, the blowing of the bridge, and that's going to be the climax. On the other hand, it's 470 pages. It's only 70 hours of time are covered. So it's a very long book about a very short time. Hemingway's earlier novels have been fairly short books or modest in length, about months or even years. So here he takes up the challenge of how to fill the time, which is for him an important step because Frederick Henry had talked about killing time. I just want to be with Catherine the rest of the time. I was happy to kill. Jake Barnes in Sun Also Rises can't really enter time. He's been cut off from it, literally. So this is a book which immerses us in the moment, in very quotidian moments of eating stewed rabbit and mushrooms, of drinking absinthe, but especially the time in the book. There's the present, of course, the very intense present, and the waiting you talk about. But there's also these recursions into memory, into the personal past, into dreams, into stories, the great story that Pilar tells about the taking of the town, chapter 10. So in all kinds of ways, Hemingway has to find a strategy that will allow him to fill the time rather than to kill it. And for me, the most important examples of that are chapters 30 and 31, where Jordan remembers his father and his mother and his grandmother. And then the next chapter with Maria, their last night together, where she tells him her personal story. People are given a story, and we therefore learn what it is that they need to learn based upon what they have come out of.
Yeah, maybe that's the answer to my next question, which was, even though not much happens, the pace never flags. It's a page turner. You read it with great anticipation. And how does Hemingway do that? Well, one way I guess he does it is with the flashbacks and the memories, which sort of slow down the pace of anticipation. Any other thoughts on that, on the pacing?
Well, I think he wanted two things. He wanted the sense of apprehension you're talking about, of expectant waiting. And he also wanted to show how life goes moment by moment, to the quotidian, the everyday, the banal, the cooking, the looking, the savoring, and the love making, of course. Time is always made for love in Hemingway, although it rarely goes as well between two people as it does between these two. It's kind of a magical thing, this love affair. It happens very suddenly, They fall in love without any prelude. They're quickly in bed. And you believe in this because you understand this is a heightened experience given the apprehension, the pressure which they're up against. And so people have complained about the love affair. They've complained about the characterization of Maria, who's quite young. But my sense is this is a romance. Hemingway was a great partisan of romance, which is to say of a heightened reality to which many of us may in our lives aspire but rarely reach. And he's giving us, therefore, an image of what might be possible for them and maybe for us.
Yeah, no, I love this idea that you can live 70 years in 70 hours. And he's constantly, Robert Jordan is constantly wondering. He doesn't know what his fate will be. He's trying to convince himself that that's enough, that time is inherently, you know, ambiguous and elastic, and an extraordinary 70 hours could be, quote, enough. It's an interesting way to live.
Well, he talks very explicitly about time. He talks about the difference between duration and intensity. And you can argue that duration has been the problem for his characters heretofore, especially for Jake and for Frederick. Intensity is what Frederick experiences in almost every moment. And so it's a model of how to penetrate duration and to live a full life. And of course, Hemingway needed the pressure of war very often. Most of his novels deal with it, to kind of create that back pressure, which heightens the intensity and the importance of the love. At one point he says, "I wish there was more time." And we do too. But the great thing is Hemingway's already given us that this book has so much more time in it, in the sense of incident, memory, dreams, all the rest that make it such a rich experience.
Now, there's two very powerful flashbacks or stories retold. One highlights what's fabulous about those two flashbacks. One highlights the cruelty of the Republicans, and one highlights the cruelty of the fascists. I think they're both told by women, which is interesting. Women are often the victims of war. It's an incredibly effective way to let him comment on the inhumanity of human beings to each other, especially during wartime.
Well, yes. Pilar tells the first story, and Maria tells the second. Chapter 10, Pilar gives this beautiful rendition of how the Republicans and Pablo's band took the town. And then they marched the fascists out, people they deemed to be fascists, between two lines of men with holding flails. They beat them, and then they throw them off the cliff. And this is an example of where Hemingway allows the other, the enemy, if you will, the fascists in this case, to become humanized. Each one has a story. Some behave badly, some behave well. But Don Guillermo is a fascist, as Pilar says, because of the religion of his wife. And he honors that, so he takes that side. When he is marched out between the two lines, his wife yells out something about, "I go with thee, I want to go with thee." And he turns with tears in his eyes and gestures toward her, and then he's mocked by the men with the flails. And at this point, your sympathy is clearly with him. This is a man who, because of his loyalty to his wife, has perhaps chosen the less sympathetic side. And we sympathize with the two of them as she witnesses him going to his death. And the terrible thing about this whole incident is that it seems like a victory, but is that the chapter ends with the line about, "And the next week or the next day, the fascists came and retook the town." So much for that victory. Yeah. And Pablo later feels true regret about what he did. So that's an example of Hemingway complicating side-taking. If I might, I just would turn to Maria's example. When Maria tells Robert about her rape and her, the haircutting that she endured when the fascists took her town. And there again, they kill her parents. And this is an amazing echo. When Maria's wife, mother, sees her husband being dragged out and about to be shot, she yells out to him in the same way that Don Guillermo's wife had yelled out to him. So there's a parallel being drawn, and suddenly the differences between these two sides collapse in this moment, you might say, of filial or of marital loyalty. We'll get back, I hope, to Maria's story, because I think it's a very important part of the book. But you're right. These are both stories told by women.
Talk about Hemingway's interest in Grace Under Pressure. It's a theme that runs throughout the book. It runs really throughout Hemingway's life. You know, you talked about that a lot of his books take place during wartime. A lot of his life took place around danger. He was a war correspondent in World War II, as we just mentioned. He, I think, drove an ambulance in World War I. Is that correct? Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes.
He's close to the conflict in the Spanish Civil War as a correspondent. He likes bullfights, and I think he ran with the bulls in when he was younger.
Yeah.
So he's very interested in Grace Under Pressure, handling difficult situations with aplomb. One of the characters says, "Help me, O Lord, tomorrow to comport myself as a man should in his final hours." And it's very sad, actually, that line. I mean, it's an incredible line. It's a beautiful line. But reading the book, it's hard not to remember that Hemingway's final hours were, he took his own life. Robert Jordan's father kills himself in For Whom the Bell Tolls, in the memory scene that you talk about, where he reminisces about his youth and his father and grandfather. Hemingway's father took his life. Hemingway takes his life, his own life. I mean, you could argue he wanted to make sure he could comport himself well as a man should in his final hours, and that was his way of doing it, given his situation. But talk about Grace Under Pressure.
Well, it's a phrase that Hemingway deployed. I don't think he used it in one of his novels. I think it might have been in Death in the Afternoon, the bullfighting book. I'm not sure where the phrase, I can't locate where it arose, but it's become a real shibboleth in Hemingway studies. I both admire the ambition behind the phrase, but I also am aware that his characters often fail to achieve it, and he's interested in showing them failing at it. For instance, Francis McCumber runs from the lion in The Short Happy Life of Francis McCumber, and then is given a second chance to stand firm when the buffalo charges. That's a story about change. And acquiring grace because you've been publicly shamed. So there's often a failure to meet the standard that then allows a character to try again. Jordan's father, you mentioned, is a good example of the case. He shoots himself, and the gun is given to Robert Jordan, who rides up to this lake in Montana and tries to drop it into the lake. But as he holds the gun in front of himself before he drops it, he sees himself holding the gun, and it's that image is mirrored so that he's looking at himself as if he were trying to shoot himself. This is a rehearsal. This is a chance for the young Robert to rehearse for the moment in which he will have to contemplate taking his own life as well, which comes near the end when he's been wounded, he's in so much pain, he's not sure he can stand it. Should I do that business my father did or not? He asks himself. And he really seriously contemplates it, and he understands he may be driven to it by pain. This is, it's not graceless, but it's awkward, it's embarrassing. He finally manages to compose himself. The pain somehow lessens. And earlier on, he talks about being embarrassed by his father and being embarrassed by the farewell at the train where his father weeps. So the father is a male figure who constantly falls short of this norm, and yet Robert finds himself forgiving him and also sees himself being tempted to imitate him, but finally, not so much through grace of his own, but simple bodily grace of the pain retiring, is allowed to remain alive until the end. And that's important. Robert does not die in this book. We know he's going to die. We also know from the beginning, because very early on, I think it's Pablo, one of the characters in the cave, says, if you are wounded in this thing of the bridge, would you be willing to be left behind? Let's utterly forecast what's going to happen. So we're told, virtually told, right away what's going to happen. And we're back to this issue of waiting. We have to live with this apprehension for the entire book. So we know this. And Hemingway loves to predict his endings at the very start. And then we have to live with that pressure.
Yeah. Sorry for the spoilers for those of you who haven't read the book yet, but it is foreshadowed in all kinds of ways. Pilar reads his poem. There's a really wonderful, extraordinary discourse between Hemingway, between Robert Jordan and Pilar about mysticism. She believes in it. Robert Jordan, presumably speaking on Hemingway's behalf, does not. He does get an unfortunate data point in favor of her view, but he also does a pretty good job giving her argument its due and in a respectful way. I want to talk about the narrative voice in the book for a minute. So Hemingway's writing this in the late 30s. And by the way, I don't know if it's correct. I saw this on ChatGPT that the gap between when he submitted the manuscript and when the book came out was like 3 months. I thought, well, those are the days. It's really quite they kind of moved that along quickly. I know they had incentive to do so. It was the Spanish Civil War was front and center in people's minds then, but it was kind of extraordinary. But he's writing this in the late 30s. So he's writing this after Ulysses by Joyce. He's writing it after The Sound and the Fury and Faulkner's work. He's writing it after Virginia Woolf. And he is famous stylistically for short, clipped sentences. And yet, reading this after 50 years from the first time I read it, I was shocked at how much stream of consciousness there is, something closer to the style of a Faulkner or a Joyce, not the same level of intensity, of course. But what it does in my reading, and I want your take, I saw that in the Kindle version, by the way, it gives you the first few pages of the original manuscript, which is written in first person. And he crosses out the I and he puts he. So he writes the book in third person, and yet you feel like it's in first person. And one of the reasons you do is that for more than one character, mainly Robert Jordan, but for others as well, you get into their head and you get their stream of consciousness in longer sentences than you normally associate with Hemingway.
Well, that's a key point. My argument in my book about Hemingway is that the early style, which is the style for which most people remember him, is something that changes. And by the mid-30s, with the two non-fictional books, Green Hills of Africa and Death in the Afternoon, he's already shifting away from that clipped style of omission and of short sentences to a much more meditative, reflective, recursive style, which finally culminates in this book. What this book is about is thinking. There's not much thinking that goes on in the earlier books in the sense of willful going into the mind. Frederick and Jake Barnes each only have one memory in the entirety of their novels, memory of home. And it sort of befalls them, but ordinarily they try not to think because there's too much that they're haunted by and they don't want to allow themselves to go there. Robert is given an immense freedom to think. He even talks to himself. He talks to himself in the second person, the third person. He's fully allowed an inner life. Hemingway calls this, he calls thinking mental conversation. And he uses that phrase at the end of Big Gerhardt River, which is the last story in Our Time, in a passage which eventually cut, a passage at the end of the last story in which Nick is walking back from fishing and he begins to think. And he's a writer, it turns out, and he thinks about Cézanne and wanting to write the way Cézanne painted the country. And he has all kinds of sort of fantasies about his future writing career. Hemingway cut that all out. He says this story does not need mental conversation. Robert gets mental conversation, and that's the difference. We get to go inside of a person and watch how a mind works.
So I want to give an example of his style that I just think is, it was my favorite example probably in the book. It's about, the passage I'm going to read is, it's about death and life. We'll come back and we'll talk just about death in a minute. But this passage is memorable because of the way he talks about life. And what he's going to say in this passage is, you know, life's pretty great. But he manages to say this in such an extraordinary way. So he says, if one must die, he thought, and clearly one must, I can die, but I hate it. Dying was nothing. And he had no picture of it nor fear of it in his mind. But living was a field of grain blowing in the wind on the side of a hill. Living was a hawk in the sky. Living was an earthen jar of water in the dust of the threshing, with the grain flailed out and the chaff blowing. Living was a horse between your legs and a carbine under one leg, and a hill and a valley and a stream with trees along it, and the far side of the valley and the hills beyond.
Well,
I'm so great.
I am so glad you chose that, because I was thinking of reading it myself today. That's El Sordo. That's El Sordo thinking about the fact that he's going to be bombed to death. And he, too, is given this extraordinary passage. And look at those sentences. They each begin with the gerund living.
Yeah.
Living. That's the repetition for which Hemingway is so famous. But in this case, it's not a sense of being trapped in a sort of capturing pattern. It's a celebration of the Spanish earth. And this is a book not about, it's certainly a book in which people die, but it is really a book about how to live. That's what Hemingway is finally coming to be able to show us. And there's so many instances in which there's a kind of sense of fullness of experience, even though it's shadowed by what we know is coming, because it's been announced from the beginning. We are given more time.
Yeah, what's amazing, a couple things I didn't remember until you just mentioned it. I forgot this is El Sordo. So El Sordo is not a particularly romantic character, and yet he is given this meditation on life. It's not a statement. In a way, those things are not life. What do you mean the hills beyond? And what do you mean the earthen jar? It's an incredibly poetic passage that is what I would say a perfect example of show, don't tell. And it allows us to imagine a down-to-earth character like Sordo having a soul with a richness that could express itself this way, right? Living was a hawk in the sky. No, it's not. So what is he saying? And he's saying that our experience of the earth really is a vivid part of being alive. It's an unbelievable passage. It's pure poetry.
Well, Hemingway loved landscape and writes about it as powerfully as anybody who ever lived. And to situate yourself in a place and to take it in visually, orally, its taste, its smells. He's a great poet of sensation, Hemingway. And he loves food and drink. There are many wonderful meals concocted in this book.
Yeah, it's true.
And so, you know, it's given to someone like El Sordo, who, as you say, is not a major character, but he's a compelling one, because he is up on the top of the hill taking his stand. It's Berendo and his men who will eventually come and overrun the hill, and the planes have done their work for them. And yet he's given, this is an example of what I mean by the generosity toward characters. He's given this as you call it, a very poetic meditation.
It's amazing. I forgot about how good the food is. They're eating a bunch of very primitive food and drink, but there's some very nice conversations or descriptions of alcohol and the passage on absinthe where he's, do you have that?
Here it is on page 51.
Go ahead.
Robert Jordan pushed the cup toward him. It was a milky yellow now with the water, and he hoped the gypsy would not take more than a swallow. There was very little of it left. And he calls it a warming idea, changing liquid alchemy. And then I guess this is not where he remembers Paris,
yeah.
But
well, this was
yeah. You go on and he remembers Paris. Yeah, the chestnut trees and all the rest.
So, where's that? So read that part.
Okay. There was very little of it left, and one cup of it took the place of the evening papers, of all the old evenings in cafes, of all chestnut trees that would be in bloom now in this month, of the great slow horses of the outer boulevards, of bookshops, of kiosks, and of galleries, of the Parc Montsouris, of the Stade Buffalo, and of the Butte Chaumont, of the Guarantee Trust Company, and the Ile de la Cité, the Foyot's old hotel, and of being able to read and relax in the evening, semicolon, of all the things he had enjoyed and forgotten, and that came back to him when he tasted that opaque, bitter, tongue-numbing, brain-warming, stomach-warming, idea-changing liquid alchemy. Now, that's an example of that kind of sentence you were talking about. It's almost a run-on sentence because the mind keeps associating and recalling and re-experiencing this catalog of memory. The style, therefore, has to capture that motion of mind.
Yeah, and that's as close as he's going to get to the Madeleines of Proust. You know, the ability of food or drink to evoke memory.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Memory is so important in this book because it's been a fugitive commodity for most of Hemingway's characters, male characters. And to be given the privilege and the power of recall, the reason that Robert and Maria can have their last night and he can open himself up to her story, which is very painful for him. He says, don't tell it. He doesn't want to listen. Nay, I must tell it. And she makes him listen and he finally surrenders. The reason he can listen to her memories, which are mostly painful, is because in the prior chapter, he has had his reckoning in memory with his father. He has been embarrassed once again by all that went on between them, by how his father ended his life, and yet he's also forgiven him. So by having Robert go into that, you might say, unresolved past, which he, at least in imagination, now resolves, he can then turn to the woman he loves and allow her to bring up her memories. And then facing those, part of what Hemingway's getting at is that in a mature love, the male character has to face the fact that the woman has a prior history. In this case, a sexual history, a terrible assault, and a trauma that she carries with her. And he, if he's going to really love her, has to be willing to listen, to take that in, and to not be derailed by the fact that she's had a prior life.
Yeah. I want to shift gears and talk about what is kind of a strange interlude in the book, and I'm curious what you make of it. Robert tries to get a message to General Goltz. So he sends
Andres,
on what is kind of a tragicomic, madcap, bizarro mission, and it does serve, in a way, it serves to heighten the tension because it delays the inevitable moment when we have to see what happens to the bridge. But it also kind of, it's almost a digression. Yeah. It's comic. There are numerous moments of of comedy in this cross-country journey, it almost doesn't fit. And you could argue it could have been cut. Why mm-hmm. do you think he kept it? And what was he trying to do there with that story?
It's a really good question. I was looking over those four chapters. There are four interpolated chapters that follow Andres as he tries to get through the lines to bring the message that Robert wants to send to his superiors. Use the word digression, and that's exactly what it is. Hemingway is learning the art of digression, which is another way to extend the time. Mm. The last day, the sort of beginning of the assault on the bridge and all that happens subsequently, fills 70 pages. The last 70 pages of this book are given to this fairly brief interval. How to heighten the tension, as you suggest? Well, you interpolate for these four digressive chapters, through which we have to wait to get back to what it is we really are, at this point, most caring about. And I think it's again giving everybody more time. And you could argue that all the memories, all the great meals, the story that PLR tells about the taking of the town, these are all digressions in a sense from the linear momentum of the assault on the bridge. This, the actual action in the story could be reduced to a short story.
Yeah.
So the rest of the book is this filling out of Robert's experience, both his immediate, his past experience, and his future expectations, because the night with Maria, they talk about, we'll go to Madrid, we'll cut your hair, you'll look like Garbo. And it's a complete making-believe. That's the phrase that Hemingway uses. They're both making-believe, because at some level they both expect what's going to happen. And yet, they're given this beautiful interval. Hemingway describes it as a complete embracing of what would not be. And this is about believing in a fiction. And Hemingway is coming to understand the value of this. He's always known it. But the ultimate fiction that these characters live out and believe in is romantic love. The other one, I suppose, is, historical change, you know, trying to fight a war to change a country for the better. And so he's highlighting for us how any of us who are involved in a love relationship have pitched into a fiction, a thing we only make true by continuing to believe in it. It's something we make up. It's not a given. It's made. And they make love in the very brief time they have. And it's real, it's true, insofar as they believe in it.
Yeah, and it's, besides the events that are going to frustrate that imagined future, they're a weird mismatch. He's an English teacher from Western United States, and she's an uneducated teenager, perhaps, maybe. She's clearly much younger than he is. And we believe in it anyway also. There's something really quite beautiful about it. It's not I know he got criticized some for that romance being a little, as you suggested earlier, maybe a little implausible, but it didn't feel implausible to me. It was really quite beautiful. The other thing I felt about the interlude of the delivering of the message was, you know, here we have, I thought this was incredibly effective, not so much in the moment. When I was reading it, I'm thinking, come on, let's get to it. Okay, then you just know it's not going to go well. It's not going to end. It's not going to end well. It's like, let's get through it. I want to find out what happens. But you know, when I reflect back on that digression, it really is. It's quite extraordinary because Robert Jordan is on the ground, literally. Through a good chunk of the book, he is in the trench, in the trenches, as we say about soldiers. He's got the pine needles around him, and he's immersed in it, and he's so immersed in it that it's an extraordinary meditative experience that we experience alongside him as he prepares for what he knows will be the decision making the emotional challenges and threats to his ability to complete his mission. And then we've got the generals, the people in the headquarters who are either corrupt, essentially, as Marty is, effective, you know, corrupt, or, you know, it's, you know, Goltz, who we have all this hope for, says basically, well, it's probably not going to work, but maybe it will. And it's to contrast his, I don't know what you would call it, ambivalence or uncertainty about casualness, even about this moment in the war, with Jordan's and his team who are living this with this unimaginable intensity. So that does give it an incredible power that I don't think I appreciated when I was reading it. I only get it now.
Well, I think Orwell is very good, too, on the whole kind of chaotic nature of this resistance, the shifting alliances, the strange cooperations. It's a civil war, and it attracts all kinds of hangers-on as well as competent supporters. So I think that the larger strategy of the war, the kind of principled aims, were so often compromised, as they are in all wars. But this one in particular was a very ugly, destructive civil war, which of course ended in more than 30 years of fascist repression. Hemingway couldn't go back to Spain for almost 15, 20 years. He goes back finally in the late 50s to write a book about bullfighting. He was denied, you might say, the ability, or denied himself the ability to return to his most beloved country because he was so heartbroken about what had happened.
I want to read a quote about death, and which is always kind of hovers over this book alongside life. And although these two quotes illustrate that, the first is, he's talking about death, everyone has to do this. One day or another, you know, there's a certain recognition of the inevitability. And then shortly after that sentence, the character says, I think it's Robert Jordan, I hate to leave it is all. I hate to leave it very much. And I hope I have done some good in it. And then just after that, the world is a fine place and worth the fighting for. And I hate very much to leave it. I thought that was a credo of maybe certainly for Robert Jordan, but probably for Hemingway too.
He continues, and you've had a lot of luck, he told himself, to have had such a good life. And later on in that same paragraph, he talks about there's no one thing that's true. It's all true, which is for him a major thing to say, for Hemingway and for Robert both, because it's a movement away from a kind of credo or a rigid code to accepting, I suppose, all kinds of experiences and points of view. What you just read us reminds us of how much time we spend inside of Robert's head. He's been injured now, and he's thinking back on his life. And it's a beautiful and prolonged meditation. At one point he says, I hope I've done some good in it. I've tried to with what talent I had. And then he corrects it. And he italicizes the next sentence. Have, you mean? All right, have. He brings it into the present tense. Whatever we had, we have. And he has it to the end. He accepts it all. He forgives what he can forgive. And he affirms how good it was. That word good is one of Hemingway's favorite words. He's often seeking, his characters are seeking for the good place. The phrase occurs in this book too. And so he's able to say farewell. I mean, my favorite saying in the book is, I go with thee. Mm-hmm. When he says to, I go, you must go, you must go. I'm wounded, you must go, I go with thee. And she says, no, I say, no, I go with thee. What he means is, it's a literal statement. He says, I want to be accurate. It's literally true. If she leaves and she survives, he goes with her, thee. And the thee, of course, reflects the head quote from John Donne, ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. So he's the thee-ness in the book rather than you. Hemingway uses thee, the formal thee. is a kind of echo of Dunn. But it's a beautiful thing to say to somebody because it's true. People go with other people who survive them and remember and love them. And that's what Hemingway's affirming, is that kind of immortality.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Amazing. You said this is your, I think you may have said this before we started taping, I don't remember, but you said this is your favorite novel of Hemingway's. Is it your favorite American novel?
I would.
What would else would be in the running if it's not, or if it's close?
Well, Sound and the Fury, Beloved, The Grapes of Wrath, American Pastoral, Philip Roth. I guess, you know, if you had to sort of reel off five titles, The Great Gatsby. So, yeah, those are books I teach and love, and there are many, many others. But those come to mind pretty easily.
It's I forget the name of the book. I don't know where I read it, but I have a collection of Hemingway's nonfiction writing that includes the war correspondence I mentioned, but it also includes this extraordinary day he spends out on the water with a young aspiring writer who somehow manages to get Hemingway to take him along and to ask dumb questions. It could be a fictional character that he made up for this purpose to let Hemingway opine on the art of writing. And he says two things in there I've never forgotten, even though it's been 50 years or so since I read him. I told you before we started taping that I read almost everything Hemingway wrote when I was young. But loved the short stories, but not so much the novels, and it's fun to come back and read the novels now. To read this one, which I loved the second time more than I did the first time. Maybe it's because I'm older and a little closer to death as a result of reading it at my age. But in that essay with the aspiring writer, the story he tells, there's two things I've never forgotten. One is stop writing when you know what's going to happen next, because it'll help you get started the next day. And that's a piece of advice I've taken to heart. It's very hard to follow, but it's fantastic advice. But the second thing he says in there, which is hilarious, and your list reminds me, he says to this kid, you have to read other writers because you have to know who you have to beat. Meaning, whose writing do you have to surpass? And of course, he was friends with Fitzgerald, and you could argue he surpassed Fitzgerald. But I wonder if he was happy with his career. I think about the following, and I want you to comment on it. He wins the Nobel Prize in 1954 when he was born in 1900, I think. So he's roughly
1899.
Okay, so he's 50. He hasn't turned 54 yet, maybe 55 yet, when he wins the Nobel Prize. So he wins the Nobel Prize, and then in 1961, 7 years later, he kills himself in Ketchum, Idaho, with a shotgun. Nothing he does between 54 and 61 is very well-received. And certainly posthumously is not well received. And I wonder, I'm not going to speculate on his personal psychology. I'm sure it's complicated. But I wonder how much despair he endured, how much bitterness he endured at the end of his life when he did not feel he was beating the competition. He wasn't writing at the peak of his powers. Or do you disagree?
I disagree in a sense that I would say that the posthumous career, I've written a bit about this, is much richer than people realize. And if you take A Movable Feast, which is published in 1964, Mary puts it together, his fourth wife, it's probably the most beloved book he ever wrote.
Love that
book. His memoir. Well, this is a posthumous book. Then in 1970, we get Islands in the Stream, which is a much underrated, again, war novel set in Bimini and Cuba. Then we get, in 1986, The Garden of Eden, a very controversial book, but it changed Hemingway's studies because of all the gender bending in that book, all the role-playing and switching of gender behavior, it reoriented the field and allowed people to begin to see in Hemingway, kind of looking back through the lens of the Garden of Eden, that he was not championing some kind of masculine code, but much more interested in vulnerability and what I call the pathos of gender, the fact that we're each assigned something called a gender at birth, which can feel very limiting as a identity. So, and there are more books than I've even enumerated that were being written and worked on in those last years. So he was actually quite productive, but what he couldn't do was finish. And so what had to happen was that other people, editors, had to finish for him. And there are more books by Hemingway published after he died than while he was alive, especially if you now include the Letters Project, this beautiful project Cambridge University Press is doing of his collected letters, which are, it's an astonishingly rich undertaking there. I think there's 6 or 7 volumes. There probably will be 13 or 14 or more by the time we're finished.
Well, I'm a huge fan of A Movable Feast. It's, I recommend it also. You want to recommend 2 or 3 short stories that somebody who's never read them might start with and that you particularly enjoy?
Well, I just pulled a book off the shelf, a house I'm renting, called This Is My Best, where in the 40s, maybe the 50s, writers pick one story or poem to have featured in this volume. Hemingway picked The Short Happy Life of Francis McCumber, which is a very long short story. His greatest short story in this, again, the generosity toward a character who's given a second chance. I Love Now I Lay Me, which is a Nick Adams story about a wounded veteran who lies in bed listening to the silkworms chew the leaves and engages in a process of remembering back, which is the beginning of this project of allowing memory to intrude. And of course, what he remembers are his mother and his father. And then I guess Hills Like White Elephants, which is a story in which a young couple, not married, are at a train station in Spain, and they're discussing something he wants her to do. It's never named, but it's an argument that builds intention, and it's pretty clear that it has something to do with an unwanted pregnancy.
Yeah.
And that story shows Hemingway again, this issue of side-taking, siding with both parties, but especially entering into trying to enter into the subjectivity of the female character with sympathy and understanding.
And I would just add the story, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place, just because I love that title and it captures something about being a writer and frequenter of cafes and bars, and it's a lovely line. How has his reputation risen and fallen since his death?
Well, it's been a bit of a roller coaster ride. I think it fell off due to all kinds of forces and fashions. All I can say, I think it's recovered a considerable amount of standing because of the deeper attention given to the posthumous work and the Letters Project and the various biographies that have continued to be generated. When I teach Hemingway, my students fall in love with him, and especially my female students. They see a tenderness and a vulnerability that has been occluded by the myth of the Hemingway code, which I think is a complete misconstrual of what he's really up to. And so if you give people a chance to be exposed to the full breadth of the career, they have the experience you've had in rereading From the Bell Tolls. They discover a man of deep feeling, of human compassion, and of careful attention to the things that make up what we call living a life. Living, to use El Sordo's word, living. That's his gift, is to make us feel that we're in it, that we're living it. as we're reading it.
Do you think he'll be read in 100 years? And if one of his books remains, will it be this one?
I'm not sure it'll be this one. He will be read. I just read a biography of Tim O'Brien, you know, the author of The Things They Carried, who is probably that story, The Things They Carried, is the most anthologized, reprinted story, I think, written in the 20th century. It's, of course, it's a Vietnam War story. But O'Brien acknowledges more than once his debt to Hemingway. So writers survive because they are refigured by other writers. Mm-hmm. And Hemingway keeps being refigured as new talent arises, reads him, and is inspired by him. I have no fear for his survival as a major figure. And I just think it's a matter of surrendering to the reading experience, and you'll be carried away.
My guest today has been David Wyatt. We've been talking about Ernest Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls. David, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.